Chris Townsend, and I am doing the session on faith and the death penalty, in case you need to be in the other room. Welcome, everybody. I'm hoping that there's lots of expertise in this room, because I am not a theologian, and I am a faithful Christian and Lutheran, but my knowledge is as good as yours in this area, except that I probably know a little more about the death penalty. So I'm hoping that everyone will jump in and join us and help us bring our best thinking together about this issue, because I think it's a serious issue for us for many reasons. And I think together we do better than we do alone when thinking about our body politic and what is good for us as a people. I don't believe in the death penalty, so I should tell you that although I will strain to hear arguments in favor of it, and I have been reading arguments in favor of it in the last couple days in preparation for this, I don't personally stand there, so you know my bias. I do deal with people who are facing the death penalty, capital punishment, in my work. That's my profession, is helping tell the stories for the court. I tell the story of the life of the defendant before the jury gives a sentence of life or death. The Supreme Court decided in 03 that it was appropriate for juries to hear that story, so they knew whom they were condemning to death. I suppose that's an interesting question right there. Who do we kill? Who do we think it's appropriate to kill? Who passes our kill test? So we should probably get to that today. One thing I have learned in dealing with my clients is that I tell them all at the beginning of their case, when I get hired on a case, I go into their prison or jail, wherever they're being held, and I tell them what I do and why I do it, and that I'm going to be poking around in all the recesses of their lives and making them uncomfortable and talking to all their relatives and talking to anybody they tell me to talk to, their friends, their teachers, their pastors, their anybody that they think is important in their history. But then I tell them, I'm going to know your life story probably better than anyone on the planet, because I'm going to spend 3 or 4 years constructing this story, talking to people, getting all of your records, every record that exists on the planet about you, incarceration records, medical records, school records, military records, whatever kind of records I can find. I'm going to ask you about all these records. We're going to go over them together. I'm going to talk to your mom, your dad, your grandparents, whoever raised you. I'm going to talk to the personnel in whatever institutions you've been in about you. And I'm going to talk to your friends. I'm going to find people who will tell me the worst things that they know about you and the worst things that have happened to you. So I'm going to know a lot about you. And it's all going to be constructed in a chronology of your life that will probably be 150 pages long. So if we lose at trial, so you get convicted, and my assumption is that my clients are guilty. Now and then I've had one that was not guilty, and I hate those cases. They drive me crazy because I feel so much, I don't know, I just have a different emotional take on it when I think they may not actually be guilty. And then if we lose at the penalty phase of the trial, which means they get the death penalty instead of natural life in prison with no possibility of parole, and then if we lose on appeal, and appeal, and appeal, if it's a state case, they can appeal through 9 levels. They can go up through the state level and up back up through the federal level and then back up through the state level. So there can theoretically be 9 more appeals. Federal cases, they only have 3. And eventually we lose, and you're gonna be executed. If you want someone there who cares about you and who knows the path you have trod here on this earth, who knows the places you've been, who knows why the things happened that happened, I will come. You know, you may have other people you prefer, but a lot of people don't want their mother because it's too hard on her, or they hate her, or, you know, I mean, anyhow, I make the offer. But happily, nobody's been executed yet on my watch of my client, so I haven't had to do that. But I say, I can't do that until I know your, what you think is happening when you die. Your notion of what your spirituality is about. And I talk with them quite a bit about that, and of course, because I insist that it's part of my so-called curriculum with them, as I sit with them in jail, it's easy for them to start bringing it up. And then I can learn about whatever they have learned about some faith during their growing up years, if their grandmother took them to the local storefront church, or if what happened. A lot of my clients, a shocking number of my clients, have converted to Islam while they've been incarcerated. And so I've started reading the Quran because I need to be able to tell those stories and work with those stories with them. I think the reason they convert is that many of our prison pastors, and I'm sure that you all probably know the wonderful exceptions to this rule, but many of the pastors, at least in the places where I have talked to them, tend to do hellfire and brimstone and a lot of blaming and shaming. And our imams tend to do kind of a calm, practicing your faith approach to Islam. They do read the Quran every day, strictly. Pray 5 times a day, strictly. Keep your body clean, strictly. Keep yourself clean, keep your clothes clean. Stand upright, have good posture, and do something good for someone else every day. And practicing their faith in this way gives people who are incarcerated a sense of dignity and connectedness to God, and a way to walk their path that they can feel good about. So I think we can learn something from the Muslim community about how to practice our faith. Dorothy Bass, the program coordinator this summer, has written a wonderful book called Practicing Our Faith from a Lutheran perspective, and I just recommend it to you very highly. I try to get the Christian clients that I have to practice their faith in positive ways in prison. And I do a lot of Bible study work. Now, if you were to do Bible study work with somebody who had done a terrible thing or some terrible things, what Bible stories would come to your minds? What would you want to do? A lot of my clients, by the way, are depressed, and they feel ashamed, and they feel worthless. So think of, what are some stories that you would propose using?
Prodigal son.
The prodigal son, thank you. What's another one?
King David,
tell us that story.
Partly because David and Bathsheba's story, and then also that goes on with setting up Uriah to be killed so that he could take her as his wife.
So that he could take...
committed adultery with her.
King David.
There's also the grief in there about him losing his son.
The grief, yeah. It's really, it's rich. It's a rich...
Well, even St. Paul.
Mm-hmm. St. Paul was persecuting Christians. How about there's a woman who is stoned to death. She's given the death penalty. Remember her? Do you remember what happens to her? She's there's some sense that I guess if you kill someone who has violated one of your community's mores or laws, if you kill them, it expiates somehow. It gets the bad apple out of the community, and everybody feels better. She's supposed to be stoned for adultery, and she's with Jesus, and Jesus says, he every time Jesus bends down and draws in the sand, you know something good, interesting is going to happen. I always wanted to be there and see what he was writing in the sand. But, you know, he writes in the sand, and I mean, he says, he is without sin, cast the first stone. And then he gets up again after he's written whatever he's going to write down there, and she's the only person left standing there. And he says, "Where'd they go?" And she said, "They all left." And he said, "You go and do likewise. Sin no more." I have a little trouble with the sin no more part because I don't live up to that standard on a daily basis, and I don't imagine she will, but anyhow, there it was. So the woman with adultery. What would be the arguments in favor of capital punishment in the Bible? Eye for an eye. And do you remember where that is? I think it's in... it's in Exodus, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Does anybody remember? Well, we can find it. It's not hard to find. What would be the way to deal with an eye for an eye? I let me tell you a story. I had a client who was a Mexican American man who was. He was a migrant worker. I'm from Minnesota, from Moorhead, Minnesota. So when I was a kid growing up, migrant workers came every year in April, and they worked in the fields, mostly in the sugar beets, some in the white potatoes, around Moorhead and Fargo, and then they would leave in at the end of October. So they lived in shacks in out in the middle of the fields with no running water. And just my mother one day loaded her five children into our old Buick and drove us out into the countryside. And she, her hands, I can remember her knuckles being white on the steering wheel. And she was, for some reason, she drove us to migrant worker home after migrant worker home. She was just furious. I have no idea what set her off. But she was showing us where we as a people have our migrant stranger friends, colleagues live. And she said, "We do this to people, and they shouldn't live like this." The migrant, where I went to a school where the migrant worker kids came to school with us, and we studied Spanish, and you know, so I had some friends that were migrant workers. Anyhow, this guy, my client, was a migrant worker who lived for the first 9 years on the border of Texas, in the Maquiladoras, basically. And his family would come to northern Minnesota every April, where he would, the babysitter was the ditch at the end of the row. He and his older sister and a younger sister would play in the ditch while his parents worked up and down the rows in the sugar beets. And over the fields would come spray planes spraying DDT and fungicides. And when the planes would come, his dad would yell, "Hide under the leaves," to his kids. And so they would. I found a study that showed that the worst possible months in terms of neurological damage to migrant workers' children, the worst months for them to be conceived were April and May, because I guess they use the most, both DDT and fungicides are neurotoxins. well, they affect your brain and your spine, your nervous system. The kids have more neurological defects if they're conceived in those 2 months because neurotoxins go through your skin, and the moms are working in the fields with 13-inch hose on their hands and knees, and they absorb all these toxins from the leaves. So their children are defective. And he was one of those. He was conceived the end of April. And then we spent 9 years having the babysitter be the ditch at the end of the row. And their shacks were in the middle of the field, so the shacks got sprayed when the plants came over. The mother, of course, was a wood-burning stove in there, and she washed the diapers and then hung them outdoors to dry, so the diapers got sprayed. Remember, these toxins go transdermally through your skin. The well got sprayed, and the well had runoff, field runoff in it. I found the man. He was 82. He'd been a science teacher in Crookston, Minnesota. I found the man who had whose job in the summer, his first year of science teaching, first 3 years or something, had been to inspect farm worker, migrant worker homes. And it was he was assigned by the Minnesota Department of Health to do this. And this was the first 3 years of that program. They had just started inspecting these homes. And the two things he was supposed to check was he was supposed to pace off the distance between the door and the privy that was outside to make sure they were, I don't know, 50 feet apart or something, and pace off the distance between the privy and the well. He didn't have to look and see if field water ran into the well. He said he didn't have to test anything, no chemical tests. Just if the privy was too close to things, then they had to tear it down. They didn't have to take away the old privy remains, but they had to build a new one further away. So anyhow, the long and the short of it is that my client was very neurologically damaged. He went to prison for rape. When he was about to leave prison, he said, "Don't let me go, I'm not well." They let him go. He raped again. He went back to prison for rape. At the end of 23 years, they were going to let him go. He called the psychologist in the prison, and she took notes on this. She said, he has tremors because of all the neurological damage, so he can't even write his own name. But he said, "Don't let me go." He'd had perfect behavior in prison, not a single infraction. "Don't let me go. I'm not well. Don't let me go. What should we do with you?" Well, he said, "Send me over there." And she literally wrote in the record, he pointed over his shoulder across the street to the civil commitment incarceration facility where you can be civilly committed if you're a threat to yourself or others. Well, she said, "Oh, we can't afford to do that." And so they let him go. And of course, four months later, a young woman was dead. And then we want to give him the death penalty. The jury gave him the death penalty. He's now on federal death row in Terre Haute, Indiana. And in the post-decision questionnaires, the jury questionnaires, it asks their reasoning on why they gave the death penalty. And they were all either Lutheran or Catholic. And up there, across the country, both the Catholics and the Lutherans have social statements which oppose the death penalty. So both faith groups as a national organization oppose the death penalty. These jurors were all Lutherans and Catholics, and they said they gave him the death penalty based on faith, on their faith, on religious grounds. So what were they thinking?
Is any of this that you're talking, this chemical situation and the chemicals he was exposed to, is any of that allowable as evidence?
Yes, and we presented it. We presented how he was poisoned in utero. We presented how he was poisoned as a child. He had failure to thrive syndrome as a child, and we showed photographs of this, of the service. of Thanksgiving in a church in Texas for him having survived his first 2 years. And we told the story. And he also had been sexually molested as a child, and we told that story. So he'd been sexually molested by a nun and by another migrant worker. So there was a history there that explained the behavior, and we called the psychiatrist, and she testified that he said, "Don't let me go, I'm not well." But the jury said they gave him the death penalty based on their faith. So what do you think they were thinking? What are the arguments that would have gone on in that jury room, do you think?
Wages of sin is death.
That's a good one.
I didn't hear what
she said. The wages of sin is death.
I don't have anything as profound, but it feels like the same thing that's going on today, where the strongest advocates for the death penalty seem to be a certain religious group in this country, and I just don't understand how they can say they are pro-life, but they are in favor of the death penalty. I don't know where that comes from. An eye for an eye, I don't think it's meant to be taken literally.
Well, an eye for an eye is in that is. I'm sorry, I should have found it. It's in an E book in the Old Testament, Exodus or something else. But in the New Testament, in Matthew, Jesus says. Now, I don't like dueling Old and New Testaments. Why can't I find, oh, here. I guess I didn't mark it.
But Jesus said in response to it, "But I say to you, love your neighbor."
Yeah. Right.
Do good.
Matthew 5.
Has anybody got most of it in their brain so we don't have to look it up here? Matthew 5. You've heard it said, here, it's Matthew 5:38-44. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now maybe it says down here in the notes where it was said, but I guess it doesn't. But I say to you, I, Jesus, say to you, do not resist an evildoer, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile.
Yeah.
Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. So he says, I say unto you, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so you may be children of your Father in heaven. So he sort of refutes that argument. I think, yeah.
I think probably, in terms of argumentation in favor of it, is the comments in Genesis following this name of Cain slaying Abel, and that whole thing of whoever sheds a person's blood by humans or by man, it uses there, but by human shall that blood be shed. So there, I think that's probably the strongest argument that's used in favor of the death penalty, at least from a biblical perspective, where it follows the slaying of another and the suggestion that then therefore that person, because the lifeblood was taken out, that person's lifeblood also is taken.
Mm-hmm. And that's where? Genesis,
yeah, follows the slaying of Cain and Abel.
Thank you. So I remember once my dad read through the whole Old Testament, and at the end of it, he just was furious. He said, "This Old Testament is terrible. It's got lots of bad things in it. I don't allow this war." And he was a pacifist, and he was just furious. But I haven't read the whole thing, so I can't say. How do we make ethical choices? Do we proof text? Do we find the words in the Bible that we like and say, "See, I'm right," or How do you make ethical choices in your lives? And how do you think we should make ethical choices about the death penalty or about any, I mean, it's a public policy issue. I always think we can just argue, it's too expensive. It costs 3 times more than giving someone natural life in prison. It's too expensive, we can't afford it, be done with it. But that argument doesn't seem to carry a lot of water.
I just feel like it's uncivilized. I mean, civilized people don't kill their people. I just don't see what could be, I don't care if you're a mass murderer. I don't see where, isn't the judgment ultimately up to God to judge?
Judge not, lest ye be judged.
I can't grasp it. I just can't grasp it.
Well, we couldn't belong to the European Union if we wanted to, because you can't have the death penalty and be a member of the European Union. So even Saudi Arabia has gotten rid of it because they want to be in the European Union.
I wonder if people make ethical choices, you know, sort of connected to your arguments in favor of capital punishment and this jury that you mentioned. You know, we associate our religion with our culture a lot. So I remember one lady up here one year who just was convinced that cleanliness is next to godliness, is in the Bible somewhere. I said, you know what, I don't think so. But she went paging and paging because this was part of her belief system, which she associated with her religion. That was her religion. I said, well, you know, that's part of my culture too. I had a mother who probably, like you, made you clean your room and so on. But you know, maybe we do make ethical choices based on where we perceive power to be and advantage instead of, you know, and that's sort of involved in our culture. If anybody here has ever been a member of a formerly great congregation, you can see that as people are holding on to their Lutefisken Lefsis suppers, and as the homeless are congregating on their doorstep and they're calling the cops. You know, they're making their ethical decisions based on their culture and calling it their religion. So, you know, that's kind of been a problem for me. I'm a white person with privilege and an education, and I need to watch out for making my ethical decisions out of my cultural assumptions instead of my faith.
The problem here is it seems to me, is that the ethical decisions, I mean, are you talking personal ethical decisions? You know, I can't make an ethical decision that necessarily affects the question of capital punishment unless I do it collectively. And if you think about it in terms of ethical decisions in terms of a society, then the question is how much of that decisions of society are ethical, they're clear. You know, I mean, we could say the society says it is opposed to the death penalty. Is that an ethical decision of the society, and am I bound by that? I mean, you know, what effect does community decision making have in the whole process?
Mm-hmm. It's not an individual choice.
No.
It's a body politic. In our country, it's individual states' rights, except in federal and military cases. And then they can do it in any state. But it's a state's rights issue, and 36 states have it currently. So a lot of states have decided. And approximately 63% of the people in the United States who are polled say they favor the death penalty. When you say flat out, do you favor the death penalty? If you ask the question differently and say, if there were no possibility of parole, would you favor the death penalty or life in prison with no possibility of parole? The number drops below 50%. So it's affected by what people know about what can be done to prisoners. They don't want the person to get out and do it again, which I don't either. So if we make ethical choices, I think we make them based on, you know, this thing people wear around their wrist, WWJD, what would Jesus do? You know, they make it based probably on their cultural notions of what Jesus would do. They make it, we make decisions based on what is in the Bible. And the trouble with the, what's in the Bible, of course, is that you, again, are proof texting. You can choose the parts of it. What?
You can cherry pick whatever you want.
Yeah, you can cherry pick whatever you want.
I guess including that the death penalty is wrong. I guess we can, I mean, aren't we, you know what I mean? I mean, I guess for every point that we have, or I have, that I can take from the Bible, including love one another or love your enemies, there's probably a counterpoint that says death penalty is justified. I would assume, but I don't know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my argument's probably the same thing. I'm probably cherry picking the other way to justify my belief system. But any spiritual practice or any religion, isn't it really universal spiritual, really underlying fundamental principles that we're to live by? And is any religion advocating the death penalty? Really?
No, actually.
Right.
There's if you want to look this up online, there's a site called Religion and the Death Penalty that has questions like, official religious statements on the death penalty for Christianity, for Judaism, for Buddhism, for Hinduism, for Islam, you know, and they're modifying their resources. So if you are interested, you're welcome to copy the website.
Ingrid, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, when the jurors are being asked to make this decision, I mean, aren't they cautioned against using their own religious beliefs as the grounds for making the decision? I mean,
not necessarily.
Because it seems that, because obviously there's multiple religions and multiple interpretations of the religions, that to use that as, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
okay, jurors, use whatever your
right.
religion or interpretation of that is to make this decision, seems really problematic, and that in the world of law that we're supposed to be using a different set of ethics that would be told to the jurors so they'd all be starting within the same, right? I mean, what instructions are they given?
They're asked, can you fulfill the meaning of the law when the law has been explained to you? But then they are also told, in the case of the death penalty, you can use any reason under the sun to oppose it or favor it. And I'm told, as a capital mitigation specialist, someone who presents these stories, any piece of information you bring into the court in support of life in prison instead of capital punishment is admissible, because the level of consequence is so great that you can't not allow anything. So I can really bring in all kinds of stories about my client's life, including religious stories. Juries tend to disbelieve any kind of jailhouse conversion, so that doesn't carry a lot of water. Although I think people who get sober when they're imprisoned and have someone like me accompanying them and doing Bible study with them or Quran study with them and thinking with them about where they're going when they die, and then they start going to worship, and they, you know, and often I try to hook in some local pastor to start doing regular pastoral visits with them. So watch out if you live in Chicago.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So do they try to get a diversity of religious beliefs on the jury, or do they just not care?
It's not one of the questions. No, you can ask that question in a jury questionnaire, but it is not generally one of the goals of picking a jury. From our point of view, the main goal is finding people who are a little bit, a capital jury by law has to believe in the death penalty. They have to, it's called a Witherspoon jury, they have to believe that the death penalty is one appropriate punishment. They also have to believe that it's not an eye for an eye. They have to believe that not every single time someone dies at the hands of someone else, the killer should be killed. So a capital jury has to fall between those two poles of being opposed and being vengeful in that way. So that's the main thing we look for.
Could you briefly tell a story about, what is it that the prosecution emphasizes? I mean, is, without, you know, that long.
The prosecution at the penalty phase of a death penalty trial is a whole additional week. It's a sort of a mini trial within a trial. And sometimes it's 2 weeks or three. Sometimes it's 20 minutes, depending on how much preparation the lawyers have done. But normally it's around a week. And what the prosecution does is put on what they call aggravation. We put on mitigation, they put on aggravation. And aggravation is clear. It's the photographs of the crime scene. It's the family's grief. It's the sorrow that's engendered. It's the consequences of this person's death. It's the egregious circumstances of the death. I've also been trained as a victim outreach specialist. And so sometimes we hire on a capital case, we hire someone who has been trained as a victim outreach specialist, whose job is to talk to the victim's family, but hired by the defense team. And the goal is to be a conduit of information so that if the victim's family's grief or pain can be reduced by learning some fact about the client, we facilitate that. If they want to speak to the client, we facilitate that. If they have if the case is high profile and getting a lot of publicity and it's up in the newspaper every day and the client is giving interviews, their sole desire is that those interviews stop and the case gets out of the news. We can agree to the client never giving another interview and silence from now on in return for natural life in prison with no possibility of parole. We don't even go to trial then. Or if like one family I talked to said the mother of two little kids who were sitting in the back seat, the mother was sitting in the front seat, was a carjacking, the guy killed the mother in front of these two babies. And the grandmother, who is now raising these children, said, I would like to have in perpetuity until the death of the bad guy, I would like me, my family, my daughter's family, my grandchildren and their families to be able to visit him in prison and ask him a question and with the help of a social worker present. And he has to answer, whatever it is. I mean, it can be just a simple why, or it can be, what was the last thing my daughter said, or, you know, whatever. But she said, I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm consumed with some question that only he, the enemy, has the answer to. And I need access to him. And we made the deal. And then death was off the table. We didn't go to trial. He was put away for life, and this deal is in place. So there's a nice sort of a more reconciling or healing path. Often people who are the families of victims don't realize that it's going to take something on average like 11 and a half years for the case to finish. It goes to trial, it goes, you know, and in Cook County and in Chicago, it takes 4 or 5 years to go to trial. And then it goes on appeal and another appeal and one thing after another. And people just sort of forget about the case for a while. So it keeps coming up, and you might turn on the evening news 9 years later, and there's your daughter's photograph. So people don't realize that they say, one of the arguments for the death penalty is closure. Families get closure. They feel better. In the Oklahoma City bombing, they found that they didn't feel better. Statistically, I mean, how many people died there? It was 460 or something, some huge number. And there's a guy, one of the fathers of one of the people who died there, his name Bud Walsh, and he keeps track and he runs an organization of the survivors of that terrible, terrible thing. It started out with more than half of the families wanting Tim McVeigh and, forgotten the other one's name, to die, and And now it's like 70% of them think there's one of, Tim McVeigh was executed. And a lot of them said, it doesn't help. I don't feel better. I thought I would feel better. And so then the other one, whose name I have forgotten.
Nichols,
Terry Nichols, has been locked up and thrown away the key and never to be heard from again. And he's not going to be given the death penalty. Bud Walsh says it doesn't work if closure is what you're looking for. First of all, it keeps going and going and going for years and years and years. So if your mental health is dependent on the legal process, forget it. It's not, you need to figure out a way to heal without depending on that process. And people lionize and make heroes of the person who's executed, and they just forget about and despise the person who's locked away forever.
I think that ties in with the question of ethical decision, because most of what happens, I think, in folks who are in favor of the death penalty operate more out of the emotional side. And I think ethical decision making conjures up more a reasonable kind of approach.
That's a good point. You know, we're not supposed to make decisions in court based on emotions. We're supposed to make them based on the good of society in a greater way.
Well, I think that the question of closure, and I know that when you had mentioned about Susan and Joe, Susan Berkelow, when we were in tech study together, we were talking about that probably one time, and closure. My older daughter was killed in an automobile accident, so there's a certain amount of things that take place emotionally. Mm-hmm. And the death penalty, she said, and I agree with her, she said, closure doesn't come for anybody in any aspect of life until you die. Mm-hmm. That's closure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably right. And what happens is that people who, at least I think, in terms are in favor of the death penalty, have a projection of how they would feel if their child or their spouse were killed, and operate out of the anger that would derive from that fear. So I think it's very difficult to deal with this kind of thing on a question of ethical decision. I think there's, for me, more of an argument in terms of what can be aroused out of the common good or what is good for them.
The court is actually aware of that. The court says in the aggravation part of the penalty phase, they disallow certain things as being too emotionally evocative. Like they disallow some photographs of the autopsy, and you know, they don't try to, they have a policy against stirring up the emotions of the jury overly much. That is a very bendy rule, it turns out. You had your hand up.
One thing I'm familiar with, the case you talked about in Fargo, so I'm from North Dakota, but the ethical choices that were given to the jury was dictated by the ethical choice of the U.S. attorney and John Ashcroft.
Yes.
Because it originally started out, that case started out in state court.
Yes.
It was originally charged in state court. Neither in North Dakota or Minnesota has a death penalty, and the maximum punishment is life imprisonment without parole.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody else made an ethical choice to give that ethical decision to the jury when it didn't have to be made. You could have.
That's a really important point. Thank you. And in this case, Ashcroft, our Attorney General at that point, was about to leave office, and right before he left office, he did a few things real precipitously. So ordinarily in a federal case, there's about a six-month process for the defense team and the prosecution to present arguments to a team of people in Washington, D.C., in the Justice Department, to decide whether this should be prosecuted as a death penalty case or not. And Ashcroft cut that process short and decreed that this would be tried as a capital case because Minnesota and North Dakota don't have the death penalty, and he had a stated policy of saying the death penalty ought to be like frosting on a cake. It should be applied evenly across the land. So he had a motive that was separate from any facts of the case.
Back to the closure part, and I haven't had a family member who was killed, or, you know, I haven't dealt with that, but in some own personal stuff that I have, I found out, it's an inside job, healing and mourning and grieving, mm-hmm. and that I used to think that, if my mother would just go away, then all my troubles would be, I would be fine. But what I really needed to do was be fine with my troubles mm-hmm. and to heal and forgive and be able to move through and accept what was on, on the terms that they were. And even recently, a little emotional, like turmoil in my own life, I kept saying, I need closure. But, I didn't need closure. I needed time to heal. Mm-hmm. And I may never get closure, but I can get to acceptance. And then forgiveness, where does forgiveness, when the people are basing their judgment on their faith, I mean...
You sound like a grown-up. Someone else can't do it for you. You have to do it. It's hard. But here it says in Romans, bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Do not repay anyone evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. So know, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they are thirsty, give them something to drink. For by doing this, you will help keep burning coals on their heads. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So, the Bible is actually not exactly neutral on the question of the death penalty. I sort of want to do a few more things about how we make ethical choices. And I acknowledge the point that we make personal ethical choices differently than we make collective ethical choices. But I want to suggest there are a few things that go into our ethical choices. One is the practice of our lives. So it's common sense. It's what we learn daily in living. What works? What doesn't work? How do we practice our faith? Does it work well to butt into line all the time? Does it work well to swear at the next driver over and give them the finger and cut them off? And does it work well to cheat your contractor or have your contractor cheat you? Or, what works? What is the practice of our lives? What makes us feel good about being human and about walking our path? Does it work to beat your kids up when they're bad? I mean, if we followed the purity codes, our children would all be dead. We'd have to stone them because they misbehave, So I think our common sense really is part of how we make ethical choices, what our experience has been. She has learned not to depend on healing from others, but to look into herself and grow through whatever it is. Then there's the, what would Jesus do? There's, I think, a study of the Bible. In a study of the Bible, I find compassion. I find, can someone look up, have you got a Bible there? Look up Micah 6, 6 through 8. I find the Bible full of love and exhortations to love and forgiveness and compassion. I think we make ethical decisions based on our cultural experience of our faith, but also I think there are some truths that we just get from looking at the Bible. And you can't be totally influenced by how your pastor interprets it, or you can read it for yourself. You have independence.
I was struck by the description of the people who are executed or who are on death row.
Mm-hmm.
Could we say that our decision to invoke capital punishment makes them a sacrifice for our failed society, so that we don't have to deal with the fact that as a society we have ruined these people. We have ignored their gifts and contributions, and because they have not done well, they have to die for us so that we can keep what we have.
I like that a lot. I do want to get to the point where we think about what it meant that Jesus died on the cross. What was he doing there? Expiating our sins. He was paying a price. Do we think that capital punishment is exacting the cost, the price of a sin out of somebody, a sort of a pound of flesh? Do we think of punishment in this country, in our thinking, as Christians, globally, as being the way to make right what went wrong? In the Old Testament, there's a lot of sacrificing of animals, and there's giving crops as sacrifices, what do we know about Jesus? What are we told the reason is that Jesus had to die on the cross? He got the death penalty and he was executed. Why? What good did that do us?
What is in right relationship with God?
And how did it do that?
Well, because God is a God of justice as well as mercy. And if everything is always okay, there is no justice.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I all my life have, or a lot of my life have been opposed to the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's my age, I don't know what, but I'm starting to see that there are times that justice should be done, that you can try to, is this over? Are we done?
Mm-hmm. What do we got?
Five minutes.
5 minutes.
Okay, good. You can try to, remediate or work at transforming a person or loving them into transformation, but that doesn't always work. And so then maybe the death penalty is the only way for some people when the crime is so heinous that that's what's called for. I don't know. For me, it's still an issue that troubles me. But I just think, I think that God is a just God, and so
when we say Christ died for our sins, what does that mean?
We're off the hook. He paid for us.
He paid for us. Does he mean he paid for us, but it's going to run out? There was only a limited amount of that largesse, and that at the end of, say, 2051, it's done?
Yeah.
Or does he say, Christ died for your sins, but not yours? And yours, but surely not mine. It doesn't say that, does it? What does it say in Micah?
It says, read all three, 6, 7, 8.
6, 7, 8, yeah.
Okay, it says, with what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?
We don't have to give him our firstborn. I'm so glad. I'm crazy about my firstborn. I'm sorry you've lost yours. But we do justice. We love mercy. And we walk humbly with our God. Jesus did it for us. He did it, and he didn't put a limit on it. He said, the people who argue this is the worst of the worst, this person is a terrible human being, there is a sense that some people would say, well, we shouldn't execute them because they might be saved. If they just, if we keep working on them, they're saved, which is really a problem. Because if we start saying we're not going to execute people until they're saved, because then at least they'll go to heaven and we won't be doing such a bad thing, sending them to hell. That's like we say that about schizophrenic people. Schizophrenic people cannot be executed while they're in florid schizophrenia because they don't know why they're being executed. We cannot execute someone who doesn't know why they're being executed. We do all the time, but we're not supposed to, according to the law. And so we have to give them medications to restore their sanity, and then we execute them. And so then the person who has a right to refuse medications, is always caught. Well, do I want to be restored to sanity so I can be executed, or do I want to be sane for a few days and then executed? We would do the same thing with faith then. If we had to wait until they were saved and then we would execute them, what would be the test? Are you truly saved? Do you understand, you know? I mean, it would be hopeless. But
we're already saved. It's already a done deal. So
Jesus has already expiated our sins. Jesus has paid the price. And now our job is to do justice, which doesn't mean let these people run around on the streets. Everybody can be confined adequately so they will never harm anyone again. I went to visit someone in Florence, Colorado, in the federal supermax where Musawi is being kept and people like that. Terry Nichols is there. And my guy that I had to go see had not seen the face of another human being for 4.5 months at the time I saw him. He's kept in a steel cell, stainless steel cell. His food has slipped through a slot in the door. He does have slots in his door. So the 12 people on his deck, each of whom gets out 1 hour a day or a night, so they might get out at 3 a.m. or whenever the guards feel like letting him go, can go and stand in front of someone else's door and talk through the slats to someone, but they can't see their face. And they certainly can't harm them. So, you know.
Can I ask a question then? But then is that, I mean, I think the assumption here is that not killing somebody is like the more benevolent choice. But to me, living that for the rest of my life, I'm not sure I would choose that as the greater.
Well, and you wonder why, as a society, we think it's important. Why do we think they can't look at each other's faces? Is it going to endanger someone to be able to, you know, I mean, we obviously carry imprisonment to inhumane. I mean, everybody in that deck on Supermax goes crazy. They all do. It's
a bigger question of just punishment in general.
Yeah, I mean, that whole question about incarceration and punishment and why we do it and how we do it and stuff is another session on a different day. But I still draw the line at killing someone. I think for one thing, killing someone is bad for us as a people. If I can kill you because I'm stronger than you, I have you under my control, what does that do to me? And we as a people to spend so many millions of dollars trying to kill people every year, I think it's bad for us as a people. It's the whole might makes right kind of philosophy. So, I mean, I told you I was biased. So, thank you very much. It's lunchtime.